Accession number 30639, Mr. Alan Davis, 3016.
And of course, some of the villagers had purchased bits of things like rucksacks or the large packs and water bottles and webbing and belts and that sort of thing. Quite trivial things that they probably purchased them from somebody on the squadron or an airman anyway. And of course, Gordon Henderson ordered that all these things would be confiscated. And of course, the villagers were very irate that this happened. I mean, they'd bought them, they thought, quite legally. And I suppose up to a point they had. But we got halfway through the village with, and everybody in the village knew that they were having a house-to-house search. And so one of the villagers, very tactfully and sensibly, came up and said that he knew where this generator was. So Gordon Henderson said, right, we'll find it and get it back again, and then then I will call the house-to-house search off. And that's exactly what we did. And I don't doubt that the villagers got their bits of webbing back as well, so that the whole thing was settled quite amicably, but quite illegally, no doubt, because we had no authority or whatever to do a house-to-house search. It had the desired effect. We got our generator back, and the villagers made jolly sure it didn't happen again.
Now, any other particular stories about your time at Campo Formida? I know you enjoyed your time there. I mean, that's very clear. But anything else, or any big stories? Gordon had left, you said.
Well, Gordon, halfway through our time at Campo Formida, Gordon left to go home, and Jack Stonier.
Stonier,
S-T-O-N-I-R.
What was he like?
He was an ex-regular, first-class man, quite shortish, very experienced pilot, a very good-natured person, and a brilliant wireless technician in his spare time. He was one of these amateur radio operators, and he... by fair means or foul, he had a tent on his own as CO, and the other half of his tent was filled with radio parts, which he managed to run off this generator I've told you about. And he actually had a private radio license and could... Excuse me, I'm going to cough again. He had a private radio license and used to call up all around the world in the evenings when the time was right for, when he had the spare time to do this. And by chance, next door to my parents living in Exeter, there also lived a keen radio buff who I happen to remember whilst I was in Italy that his call sign was G3MU. So I persuaded Jack Stonier one evening to see if he could contact G3MU, and he did, and either that night or the night after I was able to speak by radio to my parents, and they to me. So that's how clever a wireless technician he was. He was absolutely ever so keen on doing this, and very happy to contact anybody with whom we had any contact, like my parents.
How did he compare to Gordon Henderson?
I'm going to cough again, I'm sorry. Yes, well, there wasn't an awful lot of difference, really. They were both very pleasant men. Both were not very officious. They didn't throw their weight about. But they were clearly let it be known that they were in charge. But Jack Stonier being a regular and being less sort of I don't think he was as hard drinking a person as Gordon Henderson was. Hard drinking, I mean, in the sense of having a few beers quite often. But he was very pleasant and affable and efficient, and he was just slotted into the vacant space very happily.
Now, any stories from his time of things that happened?
Well, I told you about the radio. There's one thing. He must have moved from his tent into the caravan which Gordon Henderson had as living quarters, as CO, because I can remember he hooked up all his radio equipment into this caravan where he slept. And quite a lot of us had shoes or boots, probably shoes, which we'd had with a cobbler, had them studded. So we had these metal studs in our shoes, which meant the whole thing lasted, the whole shoe lasted for much, much longer. Because the leather didn't wear out. I was standing near this caravan one evening when there was lots of dew on the ground, and I could feel a tingling coming up from my feet through these hobnails. And for some way or another, the electricity from the generator was shorting before it got into his caravan, and quite a patch of this grass was electrified, which wasn't good. Wasn't good news. I don't know. It didn't cause any damage. It just caused me a tingling in the feet. And having commented on it, Jack Stonier was very, very, very quickly able to put it right. One of the things about while we were at Camp of Formidair was that I'd quite forgotten until I mentioned the tingling through my feet. There are several incidents, actually. One was that in order to relieve the monotony for us and the airmen, I suppose the CO, whenever, but probably Jack Stonier, arranged a series of liaisons between the squadron and the Army and the Navy. Now, when we went to liaise with the Army, we went to Trieste, and we took, let's say, two or three 3-ton lorries full of men, either airmen, NCOs, and officers. We liaised with the Army, and the Army took us up to the places where their soldiers were guarding the Yugoslav border, and that entailed going in a jeep up some very, very steep and precipitous mountain tracks to get to the mountain outposts where these army chaps had their camp, their tents, and all their bivouacs, or whatever they call them. And while we were there, visiting them and talking to them and seeing what they got up to and seeing how they officially stopped infiltrators coming across the border from Yugoslavia into Italy, that was the thing that was happening. And I suppose goods were also being smuggled over the theoretical international border. While we were up there, we experienced and suffered a most severe thunderstorm, and in the mountains behind Trieste, these storms come up ever so quickly and quite unannounced. And there we were in our khaki drill shorts and open neck shirts and so on, and this heavens just opened, and the jeeps actually, you know, started filling up with water. There was that much water floating about, and it fairly torrented down. All of us got absolutely soaked through to the skin, and the lightning was striking coming into towards the land in various places in these mountains. And this is the connection between these hobnailed shoes I had on, because I actually felt the lightning charging into the earth through these hobnails in my shoes, and if the lightning had come any closer, I don't know what would have happened, if anything. But it was a bit worrying that we had absolutely no shelter, no good hanging on to the jeep. The jeeps had were quite open; they had no cover on them at all. So we had absolutely no cover whatsoever, and it was belting with rain, and lightning was striking all around us, and I could feel the charges of lightning going up through my shoes. What do you do? Just cross your fingers and hope, I suppose, or go down on your knees and pray, whatever. And nothing did happen. But the outcome of that was that when we got back to the proper barracks where this army unit came from, we all had to take our clothes off because they were absolutely wringing wet. And the only person's uniform that would fit me was the colonel's. So I went back to Campo Formido clad in khaki trousers and tunic with colonel's whatever
insignia
on my shoulder, much to everybody's amusement and mine too.
Remember, what about the visit to the Navy?
Well, the Navy was even more fun. We again had to get our trucks to Trieste on the quayside at Trieste by, let's say, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. So that meant leaving Campo Formido at midnight or soon after, ready to exist for at least 24 hours as guests of the Navy. So when we got to the quayside, we just got out of the trucks and walked straight on to a fleet of, I don't know how many, perhaps half a dozen minesweepers. And there was no question of who went where. You just got onto the minesweeper that was closest to you. So by the time we got the men onto the minesweepers that would have them, we had no choice but to walk up the plank into the leading, or what turned out to be the leading minesweeper, and the flotilla leader was I suppose he was a lieutenant commander, and as soon as we'd gone on board, all these half a dozen minesweepers left Trieste harbour, and we steamed out into the Adriatic, where they started minesweeping for real. Now this was an unexpected excitement, because they knew where they'd, that must be very clever navigation, they knew where they'd finished minesweeping the day before, so they merely started sweeping from where they left off, and they put out these, well, I think they're called paravanes, they're cylindrical steel bullet shaped tanks which flow through the water, and they are attached to the ship, to the minesweeper, by a long cable, and it's the cable that does the minesweeping, because that is weighted down so that it's 6 or 7 feet below the surface of the water, and it pulls up, severs, detaches anyway, the mines from the chain that they're attached to the floor of the ocean with. And so we proceeded for some time without sweeping any of these mines up, but finally one appeared, and then the object of the exercise is to all ranks crowd round the appropriate side of the minesweeper, and they have one or two rifles with live shot in them. And they poop off these rifles. It seems a very amateurish way of doing it, but they poop off these rifles in the hope that they will strike one of these antenna or horns on the mine and cause it to blow up. And if it doesn't blow up, they either, I suppose the frame of the mine is getting pretty rotten by this time of, you know, a year after the war ended. So it punctures the mine and it sinks. presumably if it sinks it it renders it no further value and no further harm. Anyway, this particular mine, that the one mine which we swept up from the leading flotilla, anyway, the leading ship of the flotilla, it was bobbing around some 50, 60 yards away from the boat. And nobody could seem to sink this particular mine on this particular occasion. So I asked if I might have a go, as you do. And I don't know whether it was me, because there were several rifles firing at the same time, because it was not important who sank the bloody thing. But I must admit that soon after I started firing, whether it was me or not, anyway, this mine exploded. And it explodes 50 yards off the ship, apart from kicking up a terrific amount of spray and so on from the water. It does no harm, and you know, that's it. So, you know, we spent some hours doing this, and I discovered that soon after we got on board that one of the young lieutenants on the minesweeper was the product of a university air squad, university naval squadron. So he, like me, had been on one of these university short courses. So we had that in common, and which made us, I suppose, bigger buddies than we otherwise would have been. But he was extremely attentive to us, looked after us very well. There must have been several of us on, besides me, on this particular minesweeper. And so on the way back, in the early evening, I suppose, having been very well looked after on these ships, the flotilla leader signalled all hands to bathe. So all six minesweepers hove to, just floated, and that was it. All ranks, all hands to bathe. So this young man, the lieutenant, loaned me his swimming trunks, and I don't know what the others used, but most of us went off the side and dived in and swam in the deepest water I think I've probably ever swum in. It was absolutely superb. The water was very buoyant, obviously very deep, very clean, except that there were a vast number of jellyfish floating by. And the non-swimmers found it their duty to go up in the bow of the ship and shout out if a particularly large jellyfish was going to float by, which we all studiously avoided so that we didn't get wrapped up in being stung by a stupid jellyfish in the middle of the Adriatic. So after, I suppose, 20 minutes, half an hour, the skipper called, you know, all hands to come back on board, and we scrambled up the landing nets and that sort of thing that they'd let down over the side, and that was the end of the swim. But it wasn't difficult to get back on board, because these small minesweepers didn't have very high sides to them on the deck, so it was no bother getting back in. But I had the most superb swim. And it was a very hot day, so it was very well worthwhile. And then to cap it all, this young lieutenant produced a towel and a bar of soap and showed me to his cabin, which had an adjacent, hardly ensuite, but an adjacent shower. So I had a hot seawater shower with his soap and his towel, you know, and able to put on my khaki drill uniform, and feel very much that I had a very enjoyable day out. But it was a great experience, and to actually go minesweeping with the Royal Navy is quite an experience. And I wouldn't have thought to tell you about this if I hadn't remembered that this blooming electricity shooting up through my hobnails on my boots or my shoes.
Now, how long did you stay at Campo Formida? Did you go anywhere else after that?
No.
Or were you demobilised?
No. When we were at Campo Formido, We got a signal through one day to say that the 225 squadron had been disbanded.
And when was this?
And this would have been somewhere around I think it was March 1947.
So you were there a long time.
Yep, we were there, what, 6 months, did that make it?
Now, was the squadron running down during this whole period?
Yes, it was, because, as I say, various people started getting sent home, and by lack of manpower, things started to run down, and, you know, we got to the stage where there were not enough fitters and riggers to keep the airplane serviced quickly enough. So the little flying we were doing, we got even less flying. Anyway, sometime probably March 1947, the signal came through to say that 225 had been disbanded.
How did you feel? Was there a party or what? Anything happened to mark it, or had everyone gone?
A lot of people had gone, but there was still a nucleus of, you know, there were still 10 or 12 pilots left, for example, to fly the airplanes. And I experienced a feeling of great disappointment, sadness that 225, which had become so dear to me and to, I think, most of the others that were there, had been, as it were, wiped off the sheet. It no longer existed. So probably breaking all the rules there were, Jack Stonier said, right, we'll have one last fly past. So we got every aircraft that was serviceable. There will only be about six or nine of them, I suppose. So we had about 12 aircraft altogether. About nine of them would be available, fit to fly. And so we all took off, and we had a formation fly past, which I found myself leading. I don't know why, because I certainly wasn't the most senior person there, but that I certainly found myself leading this particular formation, which is pretty ragged, not as tidy as I would have hoped. But we managed to fly in formation over Oudenay as a sort of fond farewell, and we flew at fairly low level, not too low, but fairly low level over the squadron, so that the airmen could see the aircraft in the squadron in the air for the last time. And it was uneventful. Although we were not very, very practiced at formation flying, at least we got a formation in the air and down again in nine separate pieces. Anyway, so that was the end of 225, and thereafter the aircraft then got dispersed either to a maintenance unit or to another squadron, and some of us were sent off. Some of them were sent off to I don't know quite where they went to, but they went back to North Africa. They didn't stay in Italy, and half a dozen of us got selected to join another squadron, which is number 253 squadron, down at Treviso, which is right close to Venice, which on the mainland, whereas Venice is on a bit of an island, but it's just 5 or 10 miles north of Venice. And Treviso, well known now for its very famous rugby team, was the airfield from which we flew. And there were a number of squadrons there besides 253. 253 squadron, I learned later on, had been one of the famous Battle of Britain squadron back in its heyday, but it certainly was far from that.
What state was the unit in?
Well, it was also running down, but it wasn't as run down as 225 had been. So we had a new CO, a chap called squadron leader Otterwell.
Otterwell.
O-T-T-E-W-E-L-L. Otterwell.
His first name?
I don't remember. I'm sorry, I don't remember. I probably have his signature, but it's not clear from
And what were you flying, if you were flying?
We were flying Spitfires again, Spitfire 9s, but instead of having the clip wing version, we had the ordinary elongated wing version, which gave it a slightly different mark, I suppose. It was a 9A, B or C, the difference doesn't really matter. They were exactly the same to fly, but they were a straight fighter squadron, not fighter reconnaissance, so we did an awful lot more formation flying, but we did the same cross countries and aerobatics and so on that were required of us. And we went with 253 squadron. It was the
anything about the training flights, or are they just routine?
No, they were all routine flights again, but 253 squadron was in fact the state of Hyderabad state squadron. That was a squadron which had been formed, or if it wasn't formed by, it was adopted by the Sultan of Hyderabad, who had enough money to buy the whole squadron, and every Christmas he would send a free 100 cigarettes, or I don't know how many cigarettes it was, to every member of the squadron. So we were there in Christmas 40.
So if you left 225 in March, you were with them a long time. 253.
Yeah, seemingly, I didn't realise until I started talking that can't have been there. It's quite a Christmas, because Christmas 1946 we were at 225 squadron, and I see that my last thing signed by Otterwell for 253 squadron was dated the 19th of May 1947.
Now that sounds much more likely. So anyway, the point is there were links with Hyderabad.
There were links with Hyderabad, and that was apparently, but I never got the cigarettes, obviously.
Were you awaiting demobilisation by this time?
Not really, but my Dean Mob number was coming closer. So I got sent back to England from Treviso.
In May?
In May. And I don't know, can't remember where I reported to, but I only had about 3-4 months left to do before I expected my Dean Mob number to come up. And my Dean Mob number was 56, as far as I remember. I mean, I may not be quite accurate with that. When we got back to UK, more or less they said, well, you're grounded, you're not going to be flying anymore. Where would you like to go? And I said, well, I'd like to go near as home as possible. Is there any possibility of going to RAF Exeter? They said, no, there's no vacancy for anybody there. But you could go to RAF, I couldn't remember the name of the place, RAF Chivenor. Now, Chivenor is in North Devon, near Barnstable. And so I went there and again reported to the adjutant. And he said, oh, yes, well, you're not flying, so we're short of a catering officer. Do you know anything about catering? I said, no, not a thing. He said, right, you're a catering officer. So I was made so-say catering officer at RAF Chivenor.
What did that mean? Or did it mean nothing? Well, your NCOs, did it?
It meant very little, because we had a hopefully, as you would hope, a very efficient flight sergeant who had run the catering perfectly well without a catering officer. And he didn't particularly want any guidance or help from somebody who didn't know anything about it. So we had a sort of non-aggression pact. I wouldn't interfere with him if he didn't want me to, but if he wanted any help in any particular way, I would be happy to represent him and the catering staff. And I suppose I was there about a month as associate catering officer, again bored to tears. skiving off as often as I could, because there was a direct train service from very close to RAF Chivenor back to Exeter, a bit like